Tonight on Coast to Coast, we will talk about Rogerson's Book of Numbers, the culture of numbers, from 1001 Nights to the Seven Wonders of the World. What do these numbers mean? And are some of them evil? You know, when you talk about 666 and things like that. We'll be back in a moment with Barnaby Rogerson on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we've got a fascinating different program for you tonight. Barnaby Rogerson is an author, publisher, together with his partner, Rose Baring. He runs Eland Books. Now, that specializes in classics of travel literature. He's also the author of acclaimed biographies of the Prophet Muhammad, for example. Writes travel guides, Morocco, Cyprus, Istanbul. And here's Barnaby Rogerson on Coast to Coast, author of Rogerson's Book of Numbers. Barnaby, how are you?
Good morning. Well, good morning in London.
Good to have you. What time is it there now? About 7, 8 o'clock?
Yes, we've got dawn breaking through. Quiet London street at the moment. It'll get busier.
Well, good to have you with us for a few hours tonight. I'm looking forward to this. How'd you get interested in numbers?
I suppose I've my major obsession is sort of world mythology and history. But I also, as a young writer, realized you were getting a bit bored sitting in the corner tapping away, and I worked building garden temples and underground grottos with a sort of team of sculptors and jewelers. And our biggest job in Leeds Castle in Kent, hidden beneath them, a great yew maze, was this sort of underground dome. And we're playing around with the different concepts of subdividing this dome, this circle, as it were, into different divisions. And that, I think that was the little sort of grit in the pearl of how you divide and how you illustrate really quite profound ideas with quite simple colors and shapes.
And the more you got into this, the more you began to, I think, realize that these numbers do all kinds of things on this planet. I mean, we're going to go through a lot of them, and you can explain why and how. For example, we just missed it. Friday the 13th, missed it by a few days. I mean, another day or two, we could have hit it on a Friday. We did not. But what does 13 mean? Why do people think it's unlucky?
Well, 13 goes really to the heart of the whole ancient Western tradition. I mean, most people think in terms of Friday, 13th, it ties in with our memory of Easter, of the preordained gathering of 12, the Last Supper, that one of that 12 is a traitor. Your best friend is going to give you a kiss, and you're going to be marked out, and then Jesus is going to be taken off for execution. So there's all that embedded in it. You know, Napoleon, FDR would never have a dinner table with 13 on them. They would just sort of felt that it was inviting, I think, some betrayal and preordained sacrifice. So that's the sort of early Christian sort of backbone to Friday the 13th. But way deep beyond that is the very earliest conception of the power of numbers in human mentality. It probably goes back hundreds of thousands of years when we're hunter-gatherers who spent a lot of time out looking at the stars. And one of the miracles of the world was that by observing the cycle of the moon from, you know, its decline, its rise, you worked out that it was sort of a 30-day cycle. Marvelous. You could notch that on your bone and realize that 12 of those fitted in to the solar year of the four seasons. So that was a fantastic breakthrough moment. There was this sort of harmony of 12 and with summer, spring, autumn. But then as things got more sophisticated, as accounting got, and I think it was very, very early on, it got incredibly sophisticated, way before man could write, he was still communicating these wonderful ideas, they realized it was actually out of sync, that there are 365 days in the year, not 360. And so the 13th month was this stumpy little 5-day, or 4-day month, and it was always full of disorder. It was always something that fit into the harmonious pattern.
Yeah, chaos. And
all civilizations, sort of, you know, Aztec, whatever, knew that was a time when the dark spirits, when the lords of misrule were let loose, the world was out of harmony. And so that still brings a sort of shiver to my spine about, you know, why 13 is preordained to be bad.
Do people create the bad part of that number? I mean, do they just, because they're so concerned about it, they think about it, are they basically manifesting it?
Of course. I mean, that's the wise perception. There's a friend of mine used to say, nonsense, 13 is my lucky number. It's a great day to fly. You know, you get, you know, two seats to yourself. And you can turn it around. And certainly, I think when we had 13 to dinner with my mother, she would put a teddy bear out. And that would, you know, the teddy bear would be toasted as well. You can have fun with 13. It doesn't have to be bad. But, you know, some people feel odd if they're given in a group group of a dozen people and you're given the 13th bedroom, you know, number 13. You do a little swallow, even if you're in complete in control of your own fate.
No doubt. Now, 666, of course, has been tied into the sign of the beast, evil, the devil. How'd that happen?
Well, we've got a pretty clear sort of first instance of where that happens. It's from St. John's Revelations, not in the Gospels, this sort of extra book with full of wonderful numerical power and sort of haunting poetic images. But he writes specifically, here is wisdom. Let him that have understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. That's in the Old English translation. And using the very old science of gematria, which is to give letters numerical value, if you decoded Nero Caesar into Hebrew, to written Hebrew, and put it through this gematrian code, that revealed the ruling emperor who was persecuting the Jews in Rome and the Christians. And St. John and all the gospel writers were trying to, you know, make Christianity attractive to the Roman Empire, so they couldn't out their sort of fury at this dynasty. And so most people consider it it's a code identification for this sort of hideous tyrant. What gives it an added chill, and this was pointed out to me a couple of years ago, is that if you add all the Roman numerals, you know, D for 500, C for 100, you know, L for 50, X for 10, if you add all of those together, it produces 666. And another sort of wonderful coincidence or something else to give a little sort of flex of interest to things, if you add all the numbers of the roulette table together, what'd you get? 666.
Same thing, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, if you add naught or double naught, that doesn't make any difference to it.
But it is a number, it is a combination of numbers that people just freak when they see it.
Yes, and, you know, when you see all those added coincidences. I mean, if you're Chinese and they share some of our stuff, but they love this tradition of, because they've got so many dialects and so many different tonal qualities in their life. They love the trickery of the sound of number corresponding to some poetic image. And 666 sounds like things go smoothly in Chinese, so it's not going to upset your Chinese business partner to be given 666, but it does obviously spook any Western educated.
333 is sometimes connected to either evil or even something more spiritual.
Yes, I think that's just playing around with the power of 666 and halving that.
Yeah, that could be.
And in the same way that, and we'll probably talk about pentagrams later, you can have the good and the bad pentagram. But I think that St. John sort of fine spot is certainly the origin for the widespread sort of fear of 666, the mark of the beast, and it's used a lot.
Why do some people see 1111 a lot? Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I mean, 11, and of course it's got much, much stronger in recent history. I mean, very, very recent history, both with the events that happened in 9/11 and the fact it was a flight number 11.
Yeah.
And of course, going back very recently into our shared Second World War history, at the end of the Great War, the First World War was famously, you know, 11/11. And that's, but then also I got pointed out by a medieval historian that 1111 was also linked up with ancient German traditions in the Rhineland for the medieval carnivals system, that they used to sort of start that, and the misrule at 11 minutes past 11. And that added another sort of chill moment to me.
I see it a lot, the Barnaby, you know, I'll look up at our, you know, clock here in the studio. I'll see 11/11 or 1/11. It's almost like I instinctively just look up there and there it is. I can't seem to get away from it.
And also, I mean, I don't know the same system, because I'm not a great sports player, but in England, we're obsessed with 11 for teams. Sorry, Britain. Soccer, you know.
Manchester United for you, right?
Yeah. Cricket, all of that has got teams of 11. And again, people say, you know, the power of 11. What's that about, Barnaby? I mean, I can't find any particular sacred element to, you know, where medieval England was insistent there should be 11 team members. That seems to have evolved. But something, and I've been digging at this for a couple of years now, as people ask me more and more questions about it, is that 12 is such a powerful number. And we're probably talking about the 12 Olympians, the 12 apostles. The moment you get into a team of 12, you get all of that inflection. People didn't want that. for a sort of non-sacred sort of power team. So dropping into something like sports, the next one you could really go for was 11. And something else that's come up quite recently in the last sort of 5 years is that the old police forces of the really ancient world also acknowledged that 12 was too powerful a number for a team of cops. And the Spartans had their own moral police, and that was a group of 11 men. The Romans also had 11 strong team, and in medieval France, the Paris was governed by this group of 20 groups of 11 men as their sort of, very, very early sort of constable police force. And so that those are intriguing playings around of 11-ness as a very human secular, which ties in with its recent history of disaster. If these numbers are governing us after all.
We've talked on this program in the past, Barnaby, about the Freemasonry and the number 33 degrees. Does that have any significance?
It does. You know, I'm very intrigued by the power of Freemasonry to catch hold very, very early on. Obviously, this sort of scholarship of 18th century France and Britain and Czechoslovakia and everything else going into it. And we've got 33 stabs of that killed Julius Caesar by his friends in the Senate, you know, at Tu Brute, you as well, my son, and 33 years of the life of Christ. And you think, God, you know, where is this 33 coming from? And there is one of these enduring theories that 33 was one of those very early powerful numbers, because you can use the body parts in 33. If you start using counting off your fingers and then your wrist, shoulder, ankle, knee, toes, you can get up to 33, and it seems to be embedded into those. We're talking about really old cultures, way before notch making. Is that you would sort of almost tick off bits of your body parts to count out, as it were, 33 sheep or whatever it is. And if we're going back to perhaps earlier cultures where the body was broken up after death, so that it could be eaten by birds and the flesh would be taken away and returned to its bones. The breaking up of the body into 33 pieces is also perhaps encoded into some sort of very ancient memory about that, why that should be such a critical number.
Do you think groups will pick certain numbers for messages or for specific purposes?
I think pick is right, but I think it's sort of even stronger than that, sort of innate. You know, if you're going to have, I mean, one of the most wonderful early examples in perhaps earlier than that sort of Temple Grotto dome story, I wrote a guidebook to Tunisia as a young man. I remember traveling, being taken around to look at some ancient Roman ruins by this wonderful old, virtually illiterate shepherd. But in our sort of pidgin, French and Arabic, we sat on a rock at the end, having found what I had to look at. He then wanted to tell me about his own religion, not the Romans. And he produced his right hand, the good hand, and ticked off the virtues of the pillars of Islam, the duties. Then the left hand, the unclean hand, listed the things as a good Muslim he shouldn't do, drink, pork, adultery, gambling, divination. And that was wonderful, that if you're going to code a sort of spiritual commandment, the hands immediately are there, and there's a sort of wonderful authority in ticking off your fingers. And that slips into, from those five laws of the Ten Commandments as well. So if you're going to, certain structures are sort of hardwired into us for conviction.
How come some people have, well, I guess most of us do, a very favorite lucky number? I happen to like four. I was born on a 4 day, but to me that's...
I need to ask you about that. Yes. I mean, I think we're all attracted to our birthday. It's comparatively recent, this obsession with birthday as opposed to death day. On ancient tombs, the death day would be something that people have obviously in it.
Yeah.
Your life. You can't have...
not a good number.
Day. Not a good number. And the other one, there are other, Dante famously was obsessed by 11. He loved all sorts of numbers. And he wrote, his lines, 11 syllables, structure of 33 again, actually. Another 33er would be built up within it. And that was explained partly as a sort of Pythagorean loyalty to sort of 5 and 6 and this sort of perfect unity. But also as a man, he was struggling to introduce Christianity and classical culture, make it one sort of seamless group. And 11 worked for him. Bach loved it because we talked about gematria earlier. He had 14, which both for his surname and also reverse for his initials was 41. So he playfully constructs 14 and sometimes 41 in his musical constructions and things. And you can go, if you don't like the actual birthday, obviously the month number can be powerful. And then people do that odd thing, sometimes adding the birthday and the month number together to make their own sort of personal little bit of magic there, tucked away.
It's a, you know, have you studied numerology?
No. I mean, it's come into me through this work, but no, I'm not into helping people. This book is really about showing the parallels between different cultures, and explores bits of numerology to understand why some cultures were locked into this sort of way of looking at things.
Do most cultures use numbers?
Yes, all cultures use numbers, and even at the earliest, looking at the sort of invention of language philology and everything else, it's extraordinary to see what really basic words get used for one or two. Two is often connected with the eyes or the breaths. One is often conjoined with sun or moon or phallus, something really elemental in people's experience. And it builds up really from the sense of the Trinity, I think, you know, when you see a mother, a father, and a child together, locked into this sort of triangular emotional relationship, you see that, you know, there is this innate sort of Trinity bond, and that marvelous moment when you see, you know, the grandmother, the mother, and the child, three female generations, or young boy with his father and the grandpa together, off on a mission, and that seems something fantastic in the human experience.
Barnaby, they talk about deaths, for example, that they come in threes. I've never researched it. I've never studied the possibility, but sometimes it does seem to happen like that.
No, I'm certainly. I was lucky enough to be brought up by an Irish mother and an Irish grandmother, and we definitely knew that if three was going to happen, bad things, you just had to count and wait off and patiently wait for that to be fulfilled, normally in the structure of a day. And I think that goes back very, very innately, as a lot of Irish things do, to the power of the Mother Goddess, who is always perceived to be a Trinity. Again, the image of the Virgin, the fertile mother, the vengeful crone, you know, which you can put in very quickly into sort of Hindu imagery, and early sort of Celtic power blocks. And of course that connects again with, you know, although the shamrock gets taken over, gets turned into St. Patrick's badge, it seems quite clear that the shamrock or the sorrel leaf was an image of returning spring and of the power of the goddess, and eaten, you know, round about Easter, you know.
And talking
So,
about numbers, you know, the four-leaf clover is supposed to be lucky as opposed to a three-leaf clover, primarily because they're pretty rare, I guess. But again, a set of numbers that somebody somewhere came up with.
it is the four is whether it's very ancient or whether it's linked into the four gospels, into the four rivers of paradise. Four, I mean, it's your favorite number, but it's full of extraordinarily powerful images, you know. And also in India, we have the four Vedas, also have the four layers of Vedas, their equivalent of the sacred texts, four evangelists, the four tetramorphs. It's all the four directions, four cardinal points, elements, ages of man, seasons, you know. It's four is, you know, fantastically virile, strong, centered sort of earth number. And I mean, again, bizarrely, in my own childhood experience, every time we sat an exam, my mother would go into our own field, and within an hour would find a four-leaf clover. And I remember praising her, and she said, "Oh, nonsense. My mother had the power much, much stronger. She would drop down where other people had walked and pluck a four-leaf clover. None of us can do it, but she had this extraordinary." And you know, grown up in that situation, it is quite odd to see a little bit of practical paganism at work in your
Numbers.
holidays.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with your calls and Barnaby Rogerson on Coast to Coast AM. Well, just in time for the holiday season, the Holiday Magic Coast Style, a great CD that many of us donated our voices. It was created by producer Tom Danheiser, and Pat Boone is on, Whitley Strieber, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top. So many people just simply donated their songs and their voices for this Holiday Magic Coast-style CD, which will benefit veterans charities. So you can go to coasttocoastam.com. You will look at it at the homepage. You can click it, and it'll take you to Amazon, who is handling the sales for this CD. And it's easier to go straight to our website and then go to that link. So you go and see it, it's there for you, and you'll like it. And welcome back to Coast, Barnaby Rogerson with us, and we're going to take your calls as well as we talk about his work, Rogerson's Book of Numbers. I kind of like that name, Barnaby. It's kind of mysterious.
Well, there are Rogersons in America.
Do you remember the television show? It aired here in the United States. I don't know if it played in the United Kingdom. Dark Shadows?
No, but I'm an obsessive book person. I've turned my back on most television things now.
The star was a vampire named Barnaby Collins. That's a great name. Who were you named after somebody?
Sadly, I think I was named after someone my mother fell in love with when she was 18 on an island in Scotland.
I love it. You have traveled pretty extensively, haven't you?
I've traveled a lot in the Islamic world, and yeah, I have.
Where are some of your favorite places?
Well, the Yemen, Syria, God bless it, Egypt, Morocco, obviously, the Sahara, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Greece.
Areas that have been under tremendous strife.
Yes, it's been very sad, but also, you know, there are moments of opportunity. You have to grab them when these countries open. The Saharan routes, chop and change over my lifetime, the bits of the Sahara you can never go to. When they open, the wars have stopped, you've got to go. You've got to choose all 2 or 3 years, and sometimes the doors close again. Timbuktu, Mali.
Would you go to these places today?
I was in Algeria last month, and Central Asia is very, very safe at the moment. You know, in my childhood, you couldn't go there at all. Now, wonderful, open, extraordinarily tolerant, you know, female, empowered, strong, modern Islamic world there. It's fantastic.
How about Syria? Would you go back there today?
I would go back obviously when the fighting is over, but I was talking, had dinner with a Syrian friend who came over to London and met some people who worked with him over the years. And, you know, he said, you know, it's we cope with one or two bombs a day in Damascus, but he rides his horses every day. He said 2 children since the civil war has gone on. It's interesting being reminded behind the horror of the front headlines that lives are still being led.
It's a shame. It really is, because there were some regions in the Middle East that were just gorgeous.
Absolutely. Syria, I would never make a good spy. I thought it was really on the way to evolving middle class, sort of moving more centrally into the world. Extraordinary, attractive, hospitable people. It's one of those sort of, and Libya as well, that seemed very, very welcoming, very open to all sorts of things around the world. And then suddenly...
Big story today. They arrested some Egyptians and Germans for stealing artifacts out of the Great Pyramid of Giza. Jeez.
Yeah. No, that is a very, very sad byproduct. I mean, the Western Desert, I've traveled a lot in that, and that's become slightly unstable. Sinai, I don't think you can go to, but I've been up and down the Nile every year. That's perfectly safe. And in fact, sadly, there are no other tourists. So it's an amazing time if you can get yourself together to be on the Nile.
Yeah.
I mean, 6 years ago, places were teeming. Now these temples, now wait for you.
Back to numbers for a moment. Were they ever made or constructed for buildings in a secretive way, almost like some kind of a hall of records, but they were hidden away with some mathematical formula?
Yes, I think you're completely right. Returning to our early story about 13, you know, the power of 13.
Yeah.
You know, the ancient priestcraft realized that, oh, my God, this disorder, we haven't got the 5 days. But then they observed that there was, an 18-year cycle where finally the sun and the moon did get back together in harmony. And everything about our nature hinted that, first of all, you had the outward shape of numbers. Then you realize it was slightly wrong. Then by more applied watching, by more knowledge, you got at a sort of, let's call it Gnostic, a hidden truth behind, you know, the apparent chaos. There was a way out. And a lot of the powers of the secret numbers was trying to work out how this all fitted in. How do you order, you know, the stars, the planets? You know, is it their size? Is it the shape? Is it, you know, their, you know, their passage, as it were, around the Earth? All of this needed immaculate observation. And in my travels in Syria, every temple has got this flat platform with double staircases, and in Egypt as well. Because one of the major tasks of the ancient priests was to observe the stars and to work out these hidden meanings, to find out the harmony of the heavens.
I can't recall if there's an aisle 13 on planes. Do you?
Yes, because I was on one the other day.
So they do have it.
But I think, you know, I mean, you know that 14 is not so good in the East. Because on that so homophonic thing of 14 sounds like guaranteed death. So in Chinese and Korean and Japanese, sometimes there'll be a missing 14 aisle, or the 14 aisle will be where there's a sort of a service gap.
Yeah.
You know, there can be ways out of it, or, you know, as we know, 12A, 12B.
What about a 13th floor in a high-rise building? I'm going to have to look at our elevator.
You have to look at the elevator, see if they've slipped in a mezzanine that can help people. There's all sorts of architectural ways to sort of cope with this.
You know, in your book, when you read a lot about the numbers, you also read a lot about your thoughts on religion. Tell me about that.
Yes, I mean, I had the good fortune of being brought up by a very strong Catholic, my father, and this Protestant Irish sort of pagan mother with her own traditions from her sort of Irish and Scottish ancestry. And that was always intriguing, knowing that there were two very, very similar patterns, but two quite antagonistic patterns. And then I had the good fortune of traveling to Islamic countries when I was quite young. My early childhood, you know, as a baby, was in Malta, which is a very strong Catholic, but it's got this Arabic sound and the warmth to it. And then later Gibraltar, and I explored Morocco when I was 17. And so I got this other, and you got very interested earlier on, or I did, at trying to imagine what the other people were thinking and what their traditions were. And my own father's and the Royal Navy and grandfather, there's a very sort of certain disciplined core to our family life. But at the same time, they were men who traveled a lot and had a sort of an easy tolerance of other people's, you know, way of life. Mm-hmm. My grandfather served with the Chinese. My father knew some of the Druze in Syria. I mean, it was all, as a child, we had access to all these other belief patterns, which has never left me.
All right, let's take some calls here for you. We'll go west of the Rockies. Greg is with us in Vashon Island, Washington. Greg, go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome.
Earlier, you were talking about the 211s and how that shows up quite a bit. And through studying the Bible, Genesis 2:11, since you have 11s, anyway, 2:11. Mm-hmm. Is the first time God gives something a proper name. And it's the waters that come from Eden. And the name in the English version of the Bible is Pison. And it's the first time the word sun is used in the Bible. Now, an interesting thing locally but worldwide, in the last few years, on February 11th, the Pope stepped down, giving us our new pope. Also, at the same time, a meteor hit close enough to Russia to dispel more energy than man has ever been able to create in our history without killing people. And at the same time, St. Peter's Square got hit by lightning. Kind of a cool thing on the 11th side of things.
Numbers.
Yeah, those are powerful. And once you're... The very interesting thing about numbers is once your eyes are open and you start recording, it can become a fantastically dangerous obsession. Another example of the sort of that hidden power of 11 is number 23, which is linked with a very strong American beat poet, William Burroughs, who's in Tangier when he had a drink with a fellow American called Captain Clark, who boasted that he'd Never had an accident in 23 years of service.
Until he opened up his mouth, right?
Yeah, and that night his boat sank.
Yeah.
Ah. And then William Burroughs started finding that 23, there was another Captain Clark on a flight 23 from Florida who had an accident the same night. And then, you know, I'm afraid 23 got embedded in him forever and started endlessly, you know, working around. And it became this 23 enigma, which, you know, partly colonized his brain.
Numbers. Next up, we go to Sean in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Sean, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Earlier, Barnaby had mentioned the number 666 and how you could take certain letters and add up that number. Now, what I'm about to say, I realize, is going to probably upset a lot of people. So I want to say this isn't necessarily what I believe, but I know that there's groups of people, when it comes to the papacy, they said that every time a new pope is inaugurated or coronated, whatever you'd call it, there's a specific crown that's placed on their head, and in Latin it has the phrase Vicaris Filii Dei, and they say that the numerological value of the Latin, you know, those numbers will add up to 666.
Oh boy.
So there's a point of view, some food for thought for the listeners. And incidentally, I'm listening to you on 106.9, which adds up to 7. So there's that. And I'll take your response off the air. And Barnaby, I'm counting on you. Thank you.
I don't want to be the cold water pourer, because I love this story, and thank you very much. Great power to it. But Gematria is fantastically manipulable, because you can shift languages, letters get added at different times of the growth of the alphabet. In Europe, and we've got numerical power, but we haven't got numerical order in the alphabet. So Italian, Spanish, French, German, there are different numbers in that letter. So you can shift and you can play around with Gematria in a marvelous way. And you can also, for instance, in Hebrew and ancient Arabic, you remove the Arabs. Not the Arabs. You remove
some of them are pretty good.
You remove the vowels and add them at different stages of the language's growth. And you can come up with some amazing things, and people do. But sometimes I call it a dubious science, because it's open to some fantastics of interpretations and some chilling identifications. But it is a very, very ancient one. I think one of the earliest inscriptions go back to about 700 BC when Assyrians are using it, because you can also use it in a very charming way. You can put a poetic couplet above your gate or your palace doorway, and that can be gematronized, as it were, and to give the foundation date of when your building has been set up. And if you go and travel around Istanbul, wonderful Ottoman capital of modern Turkey, there are lots of these really charming little sort of couplets. And sometimes it's just the first phrase or the last that gives the code, both of the foundation date or the name of the architect or the sultan. So as well as being, you know, as a label to identify the devil that walks on earth, it also has hidden charms.
Let's go to Stefania in California. Hi, Stefania. Go ahead. You still with us? Well, here, let's try again. Stefania, welcome to the show. You are up with us. You there? Nope. And let's try one more. Stefania, are you there? Nope, she's gone. She dropped. Working with our phone system, and she just simply, I guess, she was number 3 on the board, and she's gone.
She's gone.
You think the 3 had anything to do with that?
I think she might have gone off to make a cup of tea.
All right, let's go to Elizabeth in Tucson. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Good to have you with us.
I have a question about 440 megahertz, which is the Australian thing, or whatever, the 440, the 414, the 404. Do you have anything to tell me about that? Because I'm awfully curious.
I can barely hear you.
The 440.
40, 40.
Does that make sense to you, Barnaby?
40, we could talk about 4 and we could talk about 40. 40 is one of those fantastically powerful numbers. 40 days in the wilderness. Prophet Muhammad was 40 before the first revelation. The ancient civilizations, in fact, modern Greeks to a certain extent, and Russians believe that most of the Muslim world, that the soul is only finally parted from the body after 40 days. And there are often ceremonies, you know, after 40 days. In ancient Egypt, the pharaohs, when they're being turned into gods, they had this process of sort of 40 days before they were sort of ready to be put into the tomb. And it is one of those sort of critical spiritual journeys of passage. And we talked about the power of 33 earlier. And one of the ways of interpreting the power of 40 is that, again, the body can be counted off. If you add the eyes and nose from that 33, you can build it up to 40 or 41, 42, depending if you're a man or a woman, very quickly. And that's, again, if you're a lecturer, a talker, an ancient shaman, if you're describing the world, you've got this tremendous power using all these elements of 40. And in ancient civilization, without going on too intensely, too excited about the power of 40, 40, 41, and 42 are about the same. Ancient Egypt was divided into 42 provinces, and they had these gnomes, as it were, these identities, their own symbols, their own sort of heraldry. If you go to the ancient pharaonic tombs, you'll often see that the judges of the first stage of hell, as it were, are 42 anneal judges representing, as it were, all of Egypt, all of civilization. And they've got a list also of 40 or 42 crimes of Maat, which both the pharaoh and man had to come be tested on. And so this is a very strong and primal number.
Ides of March. What does that mean?
Beware the Ides of March. The Romans were obsessed, as we talked about earlier on, about the danger of 13th. And they wouldn't identify the last 2 months of the year as it came closer and closer towards the end of the year. And they also, what I also love about that world is that they, and this is a bit of a sort of fog answer, is that they didn't have a 7-day week initially. They also had 8 days, and they structured the month into these different subdivisions, but also based on the practical, very Roman take on the fact that you needed to buy your vegetable every 8 days. So the structure of the ancient world was that the good vegetable markets and needed to happen. Cities needed these sort of these market days to break them up, and that's part of the structure of their world.
Barnaby's website linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. It's barnabyrogerson.com. And his book that we've been talking about this hour, Rogerson's Book of Numbers. If you're into numbers, he's got it. I'm going to come back in a moment, and we're going to go over some numbers. Open lines. So get ready to let your fingers do the walking. We'll be back.